Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening. This is Terry Dodd, and this is the Walls in Our Mind show. I'm hoping that my co-host Red Beckman is on with us. Red, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, Red, how you been doing today? I hear you just fine.
I've been a busy guy because we didn't have any rain today, and so I got some work done outside.
Well, that's good. Got to keep it moving, don't you?
Yep. I got to take advantage of any day that it doesn't rain.
Red, what do you think of starting us out tonight with a prayer?
Good idea.
Would you like to lead us?
Oh, I hadn't thought of it. You're the one that thought of it.
Okay. Gracious Father in heaven, we just want to thank you for a wonderful day today, a free day in our country, a day that patriots still have the rights that you have given us at our disposal. And we cherish those rights, Father. And we just we pray so much that you will help us to preserve them, that those rights will not be oppressed, and that we can stand up as sovereigns and subdue as you instructed us to do. I'm very thankful for my brother, Red Beckman, that joined us on the show and has made it such a pleasure for me to serve and to speak the truth here on Revolution Radio. And Father, I just pray that you bless this show and our listeners, and bless Red and I tonight, and help us to speak the truth. And it's in Yeshua's name, your son, we pray. Amen. So, Red, we've named this show Walls in Our Minds. What do we do that for?
Well, it's a story that goes back to 1989, and I watched as the East Germans took over that wall, and they were showing it every day on the TV news and such of how they were, and they would show how these people were there with their little hammers and their chisels, and they were breaking off pieces of that wall, and they were crawling all over that wall. And I was amused and also thrilled by what I seen, because I thought about it, how that wall had been built by the people who were tearing it down. The politicians that controlled East Germany, they didn't sneak out there in the middle of the night and build that wall and imprison the people of East Germany. They first tampered with the minds of the people in East Germany. They manipulated those people, and they got those people to go out there and build that wall. The people believed the lies that they were told. They were afraid of their government. They were afraid to speak out against that government, and they were literally slaves to that government. And they had built that wall on orders of some very corrupt, very evil politicians. And then we see these people who built the wall start tearing it down. And, you know, I'm thinking of a parallel that we've got here. In this country right now, as we're on this program tonight, the people of this nation, we have had our brains tampered with. They have, what has been, put on our backs, of course, was a little different kind of communism than what the Russians used to manipulate and control the people in Russia and Eastern Europe. They used the guns and the prisons and everything to condition the people over there. Here, in this country, it was done through the education system. It was done through the churches. It was done through the major media. And the American people are now beginning to realize what has happened to them, and they don't have to go out with hammers and chisels and destroy a wall that we the people built. What we have to do is we have to counter the walls that have been built in our minds. In the little book that I titled Walls in Our Minds, because I wrote that book after watching what happened in East Germany with the wall, I said that people have walls built in their minds with the lies, the propaganda that they have accepted as truth. I said that the lie is the building block and belief is the mortar that builds walls in our minds. When we believe lies coming from political animals, political outlaws, political gangsters, when we believe those lies, when we accept them as truth, our minds are being manipulated, our lives are being controlled, and, we've got a parallel. The East Germans had been oppressed, and until they couldn't take it any longer, they'd had it with that system. And this is what's happening in our country, and this is why Terry Dodd is hosting a program, Blog Radio, because he's one of them that is chipping away at this wall in the minds of men and women. And this is perhaps some people might not see it the way I see it right now, but I think we do have a parallel here, and it's happening right here in this country right now. We have all of this tremendous activity of people learning the truth, discovering the truth of the Federal Reserve banking system, or discovering the truth of how bad party politics is and how bad government-controlled churches and government-controlled media. And, you know, people say, oh, the media isn't controlled. Well, I'll have you know that it is controlled, because the Internal Revenue Service, anybody in the media that step out of line and begin to tell the truth, they're going to have the IRS calling on them. And the IRS in the past have literally destroyed news media who have dared to buck the system. And so I don't know if I've gotten across what I really wanted to get here or not, but it's just, to me, it's such an exciting time that we're living in right today. We're seeing some things happen that I've been anticipating, and I've been hoping that I would be around to see it, and I've got a ringside seat.
Well, you know, Red, that concept of understanding the difference between believing and knowing is a thread that goes through not just the walls in our minds, but really all of your books that you've written. And it's kind of an undergirding, it's a thought that keeps coming back up to the surface time and time again. And this is something that we as a country have got to do right now to survive, and that is to sharpen the saw of our perception. It's just like you said in the book, we can't afford to believe anything that a politician says without thoroughly checking out the facts. And basically, you know, that's what our show's about, Red. It's about helping people sharpen the saw of their perception. I've spent a good portion of my life living in a box that I was put in unwittingly from the time I was born in the schools and the churches, listening to the state government-controlled media. I didn't have a clue how deceived I was. I knew that I didn't understand everything. I knew that I didn't see everything. I knew that my perception was flawed, but I had no clue how much of the lies that I believed personally and how much I bought into it through party loyalty, just being a good American, wanting to live the American dream. It sucked me into believing an awful lot of things that were simply not true. And until somebody started shining a light on it, or I started doing my own research, really, where I started seeing things weren't adding up, and then really started digging into it even more as the light shined more and more and more, then all of a sudden it was like, you know, the floodgates opened for me to recognize just how much I didn't know and how much I believed that was false. And I've always perceived myself as a truth seeker all of my life.
The liars out there, the political animals that have more or less, I wouldn't say they were political animals. They were outlaws. The super rich, you go back to the late 1800s, and of course we had what they call them the robber barons, and they were capitalists, and you see there's a certain amount of confusion in this country. One of the most notorious talk show people in this country is always talking about our capitalist system and how much better it is than socialism. But you see, anybody that's in the know understands that it is capitalism. It was capitalist money that financed the Bolshevik Revolution in taking over Russia. Back in 1917, that time span there, it was the social or the it was the mega rich, the big rich that had capitalized, and of course you see it was Teddy Roosevelt that broke up a lot of that back there because he recognized that capitalism is a dangerous system. What we have, or we're supposed to have in this country, is a free enterprise system. You remember the statement of John D. Rockefeller, how he said that competition is a sin. And that was a clue. That was a major clue that should have alerted people in this country of how dangerous capitalism is. And of course, there'll be people out there listening tonight that, boy, that Red Backman, he's way off base because we have a capitalist system. It is not supposed to be a capitalist system. We're supposed to have a very strong middle class, a middle class built on free enterprise. It is the the big money, the robber barons, they are the ones who are promoting world government today, in our world today. They are the ones that are promoting it. It's the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds and such, because they want to control the world with an iron fist. And, you know, some of the confessions of David Rockefeller in our day, he has been, you know, accused of being a globalist and all, and he's very proud to be called a globalist. And he's not alone. There's more of them out there that are very, very much alike that and think the same way. And so we, you know, we've got a lot of we've got a lot of work cut out for us to change our thinking. You know, I can't help but think of the doctor of democracy that we hear every once in a while. The doctor of democracy. The founders told us that democracy is an evil, a vile form of government. And all of history proves that a democracy is a very evil form of government. It has never worked in all of history, and it never will. And so the founders, they gave us a republic. And people really don't understand what a republic is. Because China, they call their government governmental system a republic. They called the communist Russian, they talked about their republic. And so it's the word republic is a word that has been misused and around the world. And we need to understand what the founders had in mind as far as a republic. And that what they understood was that each and every citizen was to be free. And that is what a republic is all about. We were to have liberty. We were to be able to speak. We were able to print, publish. Bill Benson has gone through the mill. Of course, I co-authored the book, The Law That Never Was, with Bill Benson, and he raised the, I mean, he got in trouble with the Internal Revenue Service. They went after him because he was selling information for people to better equip themselves to protect themselves from the terrorist organization IRS, and he's been through the mill in the court system, and his attorney was convinced that he was going to get the U.S. Supreme Court to hear this case. And I talked to Jeff Dickstein yesterday morning and found out that the Supreme Court has refused to listen to that case. And so his free speech, the First Amendment right to free speech, his First Amendment right to free press, and the right to petition for redress of grievance, it's all been denied. Our First Amendment is, you know, it's worthless today the way it is being handled by the courts. And so we have got our work cut out for us. The Supreme Court, we've been told all our lives that they are the highest court in the land and that they have the final say on the law. And now we're discovering that we, the people, we're supposed to have the final say on the law. And the Seventh Amendment, my goodness, I'm getting feedback from all over, people waking up to the fact that the Seventh Amendment, that Seventh Amendment jury is so powerful, and it's in your hands and my hands, and anybody that'll learn the truth and discover the truth, they can use that power, and they can use that power effectively to, you know, to stop this runaway train that is running over us on a daily basis. And I've talked too long here, so I better let you respond, Terry?
Well, I wanted to back up just a little bit because I kind of wanted to follow a little bit of a train of thought here. In the second segment of your book, Walls in Our Minds, you give a description, the 10 elements or basic differences between a statesman and a politician. And number three in that list says a statesman uses truth to keep power in the hands of the people, and a politician uses lies to gain power over the people. This is one of the things that we have got to learn to discern. And we haven't done a very good job of this, I'm afraid, because we've wanted to believe these lies, Red.
Yes.
And you and I have talked about this. We've talked about the fact that we as a people, in fact, are addicted to believing lies.
To our sorrow. It's been, you know, it's sad because, you know, the rank and file out there are fellow Americans. You know, I've been talking this kind of language now for well over 30 years, and I've been, you know, called, you know, a radical and a conspiracy theorist and all this kind of stuff. You know, they just, there's such a barrier there, those walls built by those lies in people's minds. You know, to say that a democracy is a vile form of government, my goodness, that's just so contrary to what everybody has been taught in the schools and the media and such. And it just, they just have an awful time digesting that kind of information. And as I have said before, I knew that it was going to take a financial meltdown in this country, where people were out of work, people were losing their homes and their toys and all of that, before they would pay attention and listen to what we were trying to say. And of course, it's happening. The local paper here today was saying how that in December, the prices of homes in the Longview-Kelso area here in Washington dropped another 10% in the month of December. And it isn't bottomed yet, I'll guarantee them. There may be another 10% in January. At some point or another, you're going to run out of 10% to lose. And so people are beginning to pay attention to what we're saying. And, of course, the little book, Walls in Our Minds, I wrote that anticipating, and I put it in that low-cost form, and it's only, 60 pages or so. It's not a big book, but there's some really concentrated lessons in there. And, of course, that point that you just brought out, I don't dare say it, but somebody else can say it, that's kind of a profound declaration. A statesman, he will do everything he can to keep truth, you know, make truth available to the people. Whereas a politician, he just has to pile lies upon lies to keep himself in business, as a tax consuming outlaw is what it amounts to. I always try to say as much as I can in as few words as I can. And You know, I just think that we have a population out here that is not, their attention span isn't all that great, and their comprehension level is not that great, and that's the way the outlaws out there wanted it. They wanted people to be mentally incapable of comprehending truth.
Well, you mentioned one of the lies that we've been handed in our schools and through the media and the government about the concept of democracy. And there's no there's very good reasons why they want us to think that democracy is something that is to our advantage. And I'd like to, you know, one of the things we need to do here, I believe, Red, I think we have an obligation to our listeners, is to help people begin to break down these walls in their minds. And this concept of democracy, for me, when I started thinking about one thing, it just really, really made me angry. And that is, what happens to individuals' rights, to our unalienable rights? What happens to our God-given rights as an individual if we exist in a democracy?
They will be taken away because I think it was Cicero. He was a great orator and politician in the heydays of the Roman Empire. And he said, and it's been said many times by other people, and he said, when people discover they can vote themselves benefits from the public treasury, that system is doomed to failure. It is not going to survive that mistake. The politicians have been very, very adept at baiting the trap, with tax money, to get people to want these benefits, all these benefits that government is going to do for you. Social Security. We had a governor in Montana back in the 50s, in the early 50s. And he was a Democrat, Democrat Party, and I knew him. And we were having lunch one day, and he told me, he said, Red, he said, Social Security is one of the worst things that has ever happened to this country. Well, you know, that took me by total surprise. Well, I wasn't 30 yet. I hadn't hit 30 yet when he told me that. And he told me the story about his daughter that had a boyfriend that came to pick up his daughter for a date. And he said, of course, his daughter wasn't ready. And so he sits in the living room with this boyfriend, and of course it's kind of an awkward situation, and so the kid he's trying to talk and make conversation, and he told the governor, he said he wasn't governor anymore when this happened, but they still called him governor, and he told him, he says, I've got the best life. He says, I got a 40-hour a week job, and I've got my weekends free, and such, and the governor, he pounded the table. He says, what are we coming to when people think that a 40-hour week is a great thing? That's really something to be proud of. And I've often thought of that, how that he was a Democrat in the Democrat Party. But when he politicked, he was going after the vote of that young fellow that was so proud of his 40-hour week. and all. But when he was not politicking and having a conversation with somebody, why, then he had a different story altogether. And so, you know, many of these people that are selling this democracy thing, they really don't believe it, but the democracy thing gives politicians tremendous power, and that's the name of the game. They want that power. And whereas in a republic, the people, they retain their power. They jealously protect their power, and they don't let politicians get control of their minds. They keep control of their own mind. And of course, a republic, you represent yourself. You don't have to go vote for somebody to represent you. You represent yourself, and you take care of yourself and your power. But you're correct when you say it was, you know, we were taught this, and it was just pounded into us that we have a democracy. And the founders told us, hey, they said it's a vile form of government. We didn't listen.
Red, we're up against a break. We'll be right back in about 1 minute and 15 seconds.
I don't know what I can do. The government's making up all new rules. This is change I don't believe in. There are those that plot and scheme. They think they have the right to change everything this country's founded on.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dye, and I'm here with my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, talking about a democracy and how that lie that where the politicians use the concept of democracy to erode our individual rights. And you mentioned about Cicero and his statement about if once the people figure out that they can vote themselves a blank check out of the national treasury, that's the way they'll vote from then on. And that's precisely what the government does. They want the people to vote that way so that they can expand their power and continue to take away our sovereignty as individuals, because they want to control us, because there is an elite group there that are greedy. And can you elaborate on that a little bit more for the people? Because they need to see this. They need to see how these politicians make promises during their campaigns, and the people get sucked into that because of their addiction to lies. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about that a little bit more and how they use democracy in that way.
I was thinking about one of the last things, the phrases on that song that you just had. Take back our country, take back my America, or give me back my America. Or I don't remember exactly how it was, but, you know, that's the wrong idea. It should be take back your America. You know, don't ask somebody to give it to you. You have to take it back. They're not going to give you your America back that we were supposed to have. They're not going to give it back. You have to take it back. And that means that people are going to have to regain control of their own personal power. And democracy bleeds that power away from you. And you give that power to your congressmen and your senators. You give it to them and say, now here, you take my power and you represent me. And this is what we got as a result. This is what we got for the power that we gave our congressmen and our senators. We got this system that is absolutely corrupt. We can vote for these guys when they campaign for office. You remember some politician, I won't name him, but everybody knows who I'm talking about. We had a politician, and he said, read my lips, no new taxes. And it didn't happen that way, did it? We got new taxes. In other words, that candidate stole the votes of everybody that voted for him. Your vote was stolen. If a politician does not live up to his campaign promises, if he doesn't follow through, your vote didn't count anything. Your vote, you voted for less taxes. You read his lips, and because you didn't want any new taxes, you have enough tax burden, and so you voted for him. You thought that was a good idea. Read my lips. No new taxes. But what happened? We got more taxes. And this has been the way it is in this country for the last, the better part of 100 years. Politicians have been allowed to promise one thing in the campaign and do something entirely different once they're elected. Now, if we retain our power, if we keep our power, we're going to use our power on grand juries. We're going to use our power on trial juries. We're going to use that vote, and we're going to use it to repudiate these politicians that want to steal our votes. And we want to take the laws that they pass, and we want to trash can them. Basically what we were taught in our schooling, our public schools, was that if we didn't like what the politicians were doing and the present administration, we go to the polls at the next election and we elect people that agree with us that we've got to have change. And we elect them, and then we don't get the change we wanted. And it happened over and over again in my lifetime. And, of course, this is a lot of why I began doing the thinking that I did back there, way back in the 1950s. I seen this happening, and I tried to make the system. I worked on the political end, trying to make the system work the way they taught me. Those walls in my mind, I tried to make those walls, those lies work, and they didn't work. And so I had to study and figure out where in the world did our system, where did we go wrong, because I knew that our system was not built, it was not created to come up with the kind of government that we had, even in the 50s. It was deteriorating then already, and it has just gotten worse as time goes on. I don't know if I answered your question or not.
Well, you did just fine. What's heavy on my mind is that we've not held these politicians accountable, not just to their campaign lies, but there's a much bigger lie that they tell, and that is their oath of office. They go under oath to defend our Constitution, and pretty much when they get into office, they do everything they can to trash our Constitution. And I guess we need to maybe get into that a little bit and and talk about ways of holding these politicians accountable, not just to their promises, but to their oath of office?
We have to recognize that the moral fiber and that we have allowed to become so corrupted in this country. The oath doesn't mean anything anymore. I remember back as a kid, people operated in a totally different way. You didn't have to have a signed contract for everything. I remember people would say, your handshake is your bond. And we've just had this careless, we've just become careless with our honesty and integrity. And honesty and integrity, those are two words that we just don't hear. We don't live them. We don't recognize the value of honesty and integrity. It has become so commonplace for people to violate their word, not live up to what they agreed to do, and our society today tolerates that. We've got to, as individuals, we've got to check our own lives as individuals as to whether we're, maintaining, the honesty and integrity that makes an orderly society. Our society isn't orderly today with all of the crime that we've got and of course the gambling. Gambling has come on so strong in this country in the last 30, 40 years. It's just come on like gangbusters, and so much of it is even sponsored by the states with the lotteries and all of that type of thing. And it's hurting our society because of the lack of integrity and such. I had a friend that just recently passed away in Montana, and he after they opened up the gambling somewhat, why, he had a bingo parlor. Well, then the next thing was why they opened the door a little more to more gambling, and so he put in four electronic poker machines. And, of course, the state, why they're using this as a means of collecting revenue, the politicians, they love that thing. And of course, they had a guy going out there and checking to make sure that wherever these machines were, they weren't the operator of the business was not stealing the money the state's share. And so my friend, he put the place up for sale. He wanted to get out of the business. And so the guy from the state was there auditing the records and one thing and another. And my friend told me, he said, well, I've got the business up for sale. I'm going to sell it. And the auditor says, well, why are you doing that? And my friend said, well, I've got a partner that's greedy and doesn't trust me or anybody else and one thing another. And the guy, the state man, says, I didn't know you had a partner. And my friend says, well, it's the state of Montana is my partner. And so you see, there's that integrity thing, that honesty thing. It just isn't there in the business world. It's just we've lost it, and we've got to bring it back, and that starts with each and every individual. It isn't something that your community is going to change or whatever. It's going to have to be changed on an individual basis, starting with me, and you know, people have got to recognize that all of our problems with our government, there's a certain amount of it that has started right at our level, at our doorstep, as individuals. And of course, in a republic, the individual, he's got so much power if he knows how to use it and use it properly. And that's where the integrity and the honesty comes in, because honesty and integrity, this is something that we have, you know, we have to deal with other people, our neighbors, our families, and if we're a business person, we have to deal with our customers, and we have to treat them right. We have to treat them with honesty and integrity. You know, we just have to go back that way.
Well, the politicians and the media are not the only ones lying to us.
No.
The judges are a big part of this lie that's going on. Can you tell us again about Samuel Chase?
Samuel Chase, he was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He served his country well. He became one of our first Supreme Court justices. And at that time, and this is something that very few people understand, and that is that in the first years of our government under this Constitution, the Supreme Court, if there was a constitutional question came up, they would have the case argued before the Supreme Court, but they would have a jury that would make the decision. At that point in time, the judges knew they were government employees and that they had a conflict of interest if it was a controversy between a citizen and the government. And I think the case, if I remember right, was Georgia versus Brailsford, the first real constitutional question that came before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1795 or 6, I think, if I remember right. And the Supreme Court would hear the arguments, but they would discuss it and debate it and one thing and another, but it would be a jury that would make the decision. And Samuel Chase, of course, was a Supreme Court justice, and the Supreme Court justices would go out serve as judge in cases. And as I remember, it was a murder case, I believe, but I can't remember for sure. But he went out and served as a judge in a case. And when it came time for him to give his instructions to the jury, he told the jury, he said, you judge the facts of this, and I'll judge the law. And there was an uproar in this country. The word got out in a hurry that Judge Chase had told the jury that they shouldn't be judging the law in this particular controversy or criminal charge. It was a criminal charge, if I remember right. Anyway, there was such an uproar that the U.S. Congress, they took up the issue, and they. The House, they passed articles of impeachment against Samuel Chase, Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's about 1800. And The articles of impeachment, of course, were passed by the House, and then, of course, that was like a grand jury indictment. And so there was a trial in the U.S. Senate, and there was a, I mean, it was an extensive trial. The record of this is found in two volumes, recorded this action. And I don't remember how many pages those books are, but they're extensive. And the only thing that saved Judge Chase from being impeached by the U.S. Senate was his own testimony before the Senate. And you know, he knew he was in trouble up to his eyeballs, and he told the Senate, he said, everybody knows that the jury has the right to judge the law as well as the facts in all controversies. He testified in his own behalf before the U.S. Senate, and he just barely escaped being impeached by the U.S. Senate. But his days as a judge were over. He was not a young man at that time because he had been a signer of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. But he had served his country so well for so many years, but then to make a fatal mistake like that almost, it was almost a fatal mistake as far as his days of being a judge, they were over. I've talked to attorneys all over this country, and I have yet to find an attorney that ever heard of the impeachment trial of one of our first U.S. Supreme Court justices, Samuel Chase. And I guess I'll have to go back and look up in some of my books more about that trial because it really should be. It should be taught in every law school in the United States, but it isn't. And lawyers out there, they never heard of the impeachment trial of Samuel Chase. Now, here is the situation that we've got today. Samuel Chase went through all of that process of impeachment back there in 1800, and today, every judge in this country, whether it's a local lowest level judge or a state Supreme Court or U.S. Supreme Court, every judge out there, they are doing the same thing that got Sam Chase into so much trouble. Because they're doing this, they're telling the jury that they have to follow the law as the judge gives it. And of course, part of that goes back to a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1896, I think it was, the Sparf case, where we didn't have people paying attention to what the courts were doing. When you read the history of the Supreme Court, you'll find that the Supreme Court in that time span, like, 1870, through to 1920 and such, the Supreme Court was absolutely 100% corrupt. And to read some of the decisions that they handed down, they were very anti-union, and there was a railroad injury case that went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court awarded the guy one nickel, five cents. And, I mean, this was in 1890s, and the court was so corrupt, and it was more corrupt than the court we've got today, as far as I'm concerned. They were really, really bad because, for the most part, they were put on the U.S. Supreme Court by the robber barons, the Carnegies, the Jay Goulds and all those gangsters back there in that time span. And so the judges in this country are all violating the principles that Sam Chase was prosecuted for. And nobody is saying anything about it.
Well, there's a joke that, and it's actually not a joke, it was actually something my father-in-law witnessed. There was this rabbi that walked into, because he was an altar boy and grew up in the Catholic Church, and he sees this rabbi that comes into the Catholic Church, and he's watching these people walk up to the prayer candles, and they can, you know, buy a certain size or a certain prayer for a certain amount of money. You know, you could put in 25 or 50 or 100 or whatever for your particular prayer. And he's watching this, and he says to the guy with him, he says, "My goodness, how in the world did we let this business get out of our hands?" And I think of that with regard to these judges, because, well, here's a question for you. You talk about, you know, your monster and where different things are in position to the Constitution. You talk about we the people have created the Constitution, therefore we are above the Constitution, and the government, in essence, is a creature created by the Constitution, and therefore all of that, the judges, the Supreme Courts, the Congress, the President, all of them are under the Constitution. Well, that made me start thinking about these judges, because where did the concept of judicial review of the Constitution come into play?
How is it that these
because I've gone back to the Constitution and I've read it now many times. I've read it almost several times a month for the last year. And I don't see anywhere in there that the right is enumerated to any judge to do a judicial review of the Constitution.
They sure weren't. And of course they use the word interpret. They say they've got the word to the right to interpret the Constitution. The word interpret, of course, means to change from one language to another, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's what an interpreter does, is change. If you've got somebody that's an Englishman and you got somebody that's a German, and the German has something in German writing and the Englishman wants to understand it, he has to get an interpreter, doesn't he? And so they use that word interpret, and, of course, that is the wrong word. They were to determine what the Constitution requires. And, of course, as I've told you in the past, unless you understand the intent of those who wrote that Constitution, you can read that Constitution as many times as you want, but you're not going to really comprehend it until you get the understanding of what was the intent. Why did they write a constitution? They wrote a constitution because they didn't trust politicians. Now, that's simple, real simple. They wrote that constitution because they wanted a government that would not become a tyranny. They wanted a government that wouldn't tax them, tax them so much and waste their money. They didn't want that. They wanted a government that was a servant government. They didn't want a master government. And so once you understand the intent of the people who wrote that, then you read the Constitution, and it just means so much more. It's so much easier to understand. When you read about Article 1, Section 8, where it says that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, excise, imposts, and duties and such, well, the intent was to limit the power of the government to tax. They give them absolutely no authority to tax the individual. You go to Article 1, Section 9, Clause 4. It says there shall be no direct tax. They double, they tried to make double sure that people would understand that they were not to tax individuals. They were to, you know, they were to collect taxes from corporations. They were to collect the tariffs and duties, excises, but they were not, they were given absolutely no authority to tax the individual. And so, Don, look where we're at. They're bleeding the productive people of this nation. They're bleeding them the wealth which they are creating. And it's absolutely unconstitutional.
Well, what's at the root of all of this? You know, people need to see a picture. I'm trying to create an emotional word picture for what these judges are trying to do. You know, why are we're up against a break. We'll come back to this question when we get right back. Janet, take us to break. We're up against a one-hour break. We'll be right back in just a couple of minutes.
Sing, come and see, and I saw, and behold, a white horse.
There's a man going round taking names. And he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up at the terror in each sip. And in each sup, will you partake of that last offered cup, or disappear into the potter's ground when the man comes around? Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne. And at his feet, they'll cast their golden crowns when the man comes around. Whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down when the man comes around. Hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing. Multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum. Voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come. And the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In measured a hundredweight and penny pound, when the man comes around.
And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death. And hell followed with him.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd. I'm on with my co-host tonight, Red Beckman, and we've been talking about Red's book, Walls in Our Minds, and some of the concepts in it, and especially about people being so addicted to believing the lies that politicians and others tell us, or just talking about judges. And Red, I have a question for you. And I'll throw this out to all of our people in our chat, too, and that are listening. Where did the term hocus pocus come from?
I don't know where that one came from. But I've seen lots of it in the courtrooms. I'm thinking about the judges and the attorneys, how they'll use Latin in the courtroom, and the jury, and more than likely the defendants or the plaintiffs are our neighbors and such. They won't understand what they're even talking about, and that's I think that's a form of hocus pocus, and it's something that they use to more or less confound the people to the point where they have to go and hire an attorney to defend them. And, of course, that's really a serious mistake, and it's a serious breakdown of our justice system. We have that group of people known as lawyers and judges, that will use this kind of it's a lack of integrity again that brings this about, where they use that to take advantage of those of us that don't know Latin and don't know what these lawyers are talking about. And so
Let me elaborate a little bit, and then let's relate this to judges. Hocus pocus comes from the term hoc est corpus. This is my body, which is what the priest would do when they would close off the curtain and they would go back there and they started introducing this concept of transubstantiation. In other words, where they had the ability to go back and basically they were dividing the people from the Eucharist. They were actually separating the people from the true Savior, the Christ. And they would magically, hoc est corpus, say these words over the Eucharist and make it become the body and blood of Christ, as though they had some kind of magical power to do that. And that's where the term hocus pocus came from. Now, if the people understood their relationship with Jesus, they obviously wouldn't need anybody else to intercede for them and for them to have that kind of proximity to him, because the Father sent his Spirit to dwell within us. We don't need anybody else to tell us what our law is or what we're supposed to do or what works we're supposed to do or any of those things, because his law is written on our hearts when his Spirit indwells in us. Well, but the people were separated from even the truth in essence. They basically were conned into giving more power to these priests. Well, what do we do today? How many people can you walk up to on the street and say, What do you know about the Constitution? When was the last time you read the Constitution? Can you tell me anything about the Constitution? The vast majority of people haven't even read it. They don't have a clue about the Constitution. So they buy into this hocus pocus that these judges have some great ability or authority or enumerated power to judge what the law is and, in fact, what the Constitution says. It's the same principle. It's just another hocus pocus.
I agree. I agree. And I have seen a lot of this, you know, across the nation. I've been in a number of federal courthouses in particular, not more federal than state. You know, I've seen this, and it makes me very, very uncomfortable. Because I know that it's a tool that they're using to deceive. Deceit and deception are the tools of the trade in the legal profession. And of course, all of your judges, for the most part, other than probably a justice of the peace someplace, are lawyers first, and then they become lawyer judges. And they don't like anybody that would go in and present their case, present their arguments and such, and you know, themselves without an attorney. And the judge, you've really got a problem, because that judge, he looks out for the other lawyers, and he doesn't like a pro per or pro se in his courtroom with somebody without a lawyer. He doesn't like that, because the lawyers aren't going to make their dollars. And so, you know, they talk about practicing law. And one time I was helping. I had been put on as a trustee for party of their trust. And they were having an IRS problem, and so I was able to speak, of course, in court. And the judge was very upset because I was not an attorney, and he more or less, questioned me, practicing law without a license. And I told him, I said, I don't practice. Lawyers just practice. I don't practice. I do the real thing because I know what I'm talking about. And he would have loved to send me to the county jail on a contempt charge, but he knew that he didn't dare, because he knew good and well that I would appeal it and he'd lose, because he was defending the legal profession. And he didn't care about whether there was any justice in that court, whatever. He just wanted his lawyer buddies to be able to bleed off some of the wealth that people have created with their hard work or whatever. And so, getting back to that time period there, from 1870 to 1920, that's a 50-year period that that our court system really, really deteriorated. It became just so bad. The Supreme Court, in particular, they were appointed to those positions because of the fact that they had. They had connections with the big money, the robber barons, and the history of that time period is so bad. You have to read it. I think I had mentioned one time that I have a book printed in 1912, and the title of it is The History of the U.S. Supreme Court Up Until 1912. And it made me ill, practically, when I read it, because I could see how the system that we have today was corrupted way back then. And so we've got all these judges and such today that are operating, well, the Declaration of Independence says it so well. It says, after a long train of abuses and usurpations, we don't hear that word very much, do we? We don't hear that word enough. Usurpations. We have a counterfeit in the White House. He's usurping the power that we the people have, given to our government, our executive branch of government. The judges are usurping the power of the jury. They're usurping the power of we the people. They're putting themselves, you go in that courtroom and here they got the judge sitting up higher than anybody. He should be lower than anybody in that courtroom. The jury should be up there higher. And, they put on that black dress and, boy, I'll tell you, it's just like they change their personality. They just change everything. Their demeanor, everything changes when they put on that black dress. And it was falling apart. The system was falling apart back there in that 50-year time period that I mentioned. And we've just never recovered from it.
Well, that's an interesting picture you painted about the judge being higher than the jury in the courtroom. I don't know why that had never struck me before, but it's absolute truth.
He's sitting on a throne. He's got himself sitting on a throne.
Well, what do you think they're what's the lie of the day? Have you seen what that congressman in Georgia did? That deal? Congressman Deal?
What was it?
He wrote a letter to the president demanding him to prove that he's a natural born citizen. Transmitted electronically, PDF file.
Mm-hmm.
And he is the first one that anybody knows of in the history of our country that's ever done that.
That congressman from North or South Carolina that stood up when Obama was addressing the joint House and Senate and said, "You lie." Here we are. We've got the entire Senate and House that is supposed to be there, joint session. And Obama is lying, and it's been well proven that he was lying, and that's why the congressman, he just reached a point he couldn't take it any longer. But the congressman is the one that got blamed for this thing, and he was reprimanded, and the press and everybody else and his fellow congressmen and senators were on his case because he interrupted the president. Well, these people, they forgot that we're supposed to have a separation of powers. They forgot that the Congress is supposed to be a check against Obama and the executive branch of government. We had just one congressman out of 535, just one congressman that understood his responsibility when they've got this usurper up there lying to the nation and the two houses of our Congress. And there was only one that recognized that he was a check. He was to be a check against that usurper up there speaking to the people and the Congress. I think that was probably the worst demonstration that I have ever seen. As I've watched, you know, the process over the years, that whole thing was such a fiasco. And the poor guy, you know, he apologized and all. Well, I'll tell you, if it had been me, there'd have been no apology. I'll guarantee you. I would have followed through, and I'd have turned around, and I'd have told my friends or my congressmen and senators, I'd have said, "Hey, you people ought to be ashamed of yourselves. You're sitting here like a bunch of bumps on a log, and you should be on your feet, and you should be saying, let's get articles of impeachment filed against this guy." I mean, since when do they have to sit by and let the president, the executive branch of government, lie to the Congress and to the people of the nation? It was broadcast across the nation. Our separation of powers, our system is breaking down.
Well, we need more congressmen like Nathan Deal from Georgia. Joe Wilson's a guy you were talking about a while ago.
Yeah, Wilson.
Joe Wilson.
Yeah. Well, what did he get for a response?
I'm sure he hasn't gotten a response. He's probably getting the same response we've gotten for every redress of grievance we've filed with, you know, on this government. Mm-hmm. He might have got a copy of the $2 million they've spent taxpayer money to seal all the records.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, he's not going to get a response. What are they going to do? Dignify this? I mean, they do. The thing about it is that their silence is an admission of guilt. So in this case, they actually will have to respond to him. I was being facetious, but the truth is that they will have to give him some kind of response. It's going to be interesting to see how that comes out. I posted on our chat board.
When did this happen?
Well, this article came out January the 5th, and
I believe
he wrote the letter in December. It says can publicly confirm that on the first of December last, U.S. Congressman Nathan Deal challenged the eligibility of Barack Hussein Obama to hold the office of the U.S. presidency. And it goes on from there. But I posted the link to the article and at the post and email on our chat board. So I'll send you a copy of that so you can see that, Red.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought.
But we need more. We've got to get a whole bunch of congressmen elected next year that are not loyal to party. That it doesn't matter. I don't care. You know, I want people who are not politicians. I want to get people in there who have got some guts, who are going to actually make a real effort at restoring the constitutional governance in this country. People who are willing to stand up and take a stand and not be afraid of being a laughing stock or anything else. You know, they talk about Ron Paul, and I keep bringing it up. He had his chance to stand there and to object when the Electoral College was counted. And when he was asked point blank, why didn't you object? Why didn't you question his eligibility at the time of the Electoral College? And he said, he answered, this is Ron Paul's own words. He said, because anybody that would have stood up and done that would have been made out to be a laughingstock.
Huh.
And I got to tell you, that's stuck in my craw, and it's still sticking in my craw. And as much respect as I have for Ron Paul, we can't tolerate that. We've got to have people like Nathan Deal who are willing to actually take a stand and do something to represent the people and to stand up for the Constitution. Every stinking one of them that have been in that Congress and in that Senate, every one of them have broken their oath of office. Every one of them.
I won't question that a bit because I agree with you. And it's gonna. We're gaining. You see, we're we're making headway. Let me put it that way. We're making headway in this war. You know, people don't realize it, but that thing that happened over there in Copenhagen, I got a hunch as time goes on, we're going to discover more of what happened there. And I think I've got some pretty good ideas about what happened there. And I won't say that much about it other than the fact that it turned out to be a total fiasco for Obama and Hillary. They were made to look like idiots, and it blew up in their faces. And I really believe that it came about because the American people, the whole world is watching us. The Russians are watching us very close because they have tried to warn us about going this socialist route, this communist route that Obama is trying to do to change in this country. And the Russians are watching very, very close because they have told us in no uncertain terms that, you know, the route that we're on with Obama is a very dangerous thing and it's not good for our future. Anyway, I believe that we're gaining, but we've got a long ways to go. And, of course, you know, I did tell you, I think, about what I was thinking of running a bunch of candidates against the incumbent Democrats. I think that we need to identify the congressional districts in this country, 435 of them. We need to identify the congressional districts that have, at this point, Democratic congressmen who are for gun control. And if they're supporting Obama with his health care and all of that. We need to identify those districts. We need to get the activists in the Tea Party groups, the Oath Keepers, the Fully Informed Jury people, the Sheriff Mac groups, and all of this. We need them all to join together and each district where there's a Democrat incumbent who is for gun control, we need to identify them, and we need these groups like the Oath Keepers and the Tea Party people, we need them to find a candidate in each district that will agree to run, somebody that's not a politician, somebody that's a small businessman perhaps. Get them to run, and what they would do, of course, is when they decide they're going to run, then they would notice the major media in their area that there's going to be a candidate, a new candidate filing for the congressman from that district, and he's going to file against the incumbent. And he's going to be at the state capitol at such and such a time where he has to file, and that the media is invited to be there, and that after he files, he will have a news conference, and so he goes at the appointed time and files, and hopefully the media is there for their pictures and everything. And he will have a printed out press release, but he doesn't hand that press release out until he has his news conference, and they go out in the lobby or wherever, and he has his news conference, and he says, "The incumbent in our congressional district here is a Karl Marx Democrat." Because he is for gun control. And the Democrats in this district, they want a choice. So I am running as a Second Amendment Democrat for Congress from this congressional district. I am a Second Amendment Democrat. The incumbent is a Karl Marx Democrat, and we want the people of this congressional district to have a choice. Now, how do you think, what kind of a stir is that going to cause if that were to happen?
Well, let's stay on that track when we come back from this break. I do want to talk a little bit about the original 13th Amendment and whether or not lawyers should be allowed to be in the Congress and Senate. We'll be right back after this break, folks. I think we're going to have a break. Maybe Janet got active. There we go.
Faith of our fathers living still in spite of dungeon, fire, and sword. Oh, how our hearts beat high with joy whene'er we hear that glorious word.
Faith of our fathers, holy faith, we will be true to thee till death.
Our fathers chained in prisons dark were still in heart and conscience free. How sweet would be their children's fate if they, like them, could die.
Welcome back to Walls in Our Minds. This is Terry Dodd and my co-host, Red Beckman. Red, we were talking about those nasty judges and lawyers, and what do you know about the history of the original 13th Amendment?
Well, by about 1795, our Congress, which had just been created, fairly recent at that point, 1795, about that time, lawyers already controlled the U.S. Congress. And, of course, a lot of people out there have become aware of the fact that the U.S. Bar Association is controlled out of London, England, even today. It was then. And so they voted, as I remember, 90-some million dollars reparations to the government of England because we had won the War of Independence. Well, reparations are usually paid by the loser. We should have been collecting from the British for them losing the war. But the lawyers turned it around, and Ben Franklin found out about it. And, of course, he was getting to be a way up in years, but he found out about it, and he became so enraged and so angry about it, and people he got people stirred up. And so they proposed the 13th Amendment, which was to, you know, make it so that lawyers could not become part of the U.S. Congress and such, because a lawyer is an officer of the court. And so they are under the judicial branch of government. And with them in the Congress, they're violating the separation of powers doctrine. And the founders were very strong on this separation of powers. They firmly believed that we needed that separation of powers so that the Congress would be a check against the president and the executive branch. The Congress would be a check against the judges in the courts. And the Congress, or the executive branch, would be a check against the legislative branch and against the judiciary. And, of course, the judiciary, they were to be a check against the Congress and the executive branch. And they taught us in our high school civics classes and government classes, now they call them, but we were taught about this separation of powers and how that these branches of government were to be separate powers. And so the 13th Amendment, as I remember it, was finally ratified about 1818, and Virginia was the last state required to ratify the 13th Amendment. And it was to keep lawyers out of, I mean, make them stay in their judicial branch of government where they belong. And we don't know exactly. It's been very difficult to find out exactly how they managed to find a crack big enough to drop the 13th Amendment, the original 13th Amendment, through the cracks. It happened apparently prior to the Civil War. However, there have been some copies of the Constitution, printed copies of the U.S. Constitution and its amendments, as late as 1869, old copies of the Constitution that still list the original 13th Amendment. And, of course, I think Lincoln had something to do with that, and because he was an attorney, and he proposed the 13th Amendment that we know of today, the Involuntary Servitude Amendment. And so, you know, we're still trying to figure this out, how that original 13th Amendment could be removed as it was. But let me say this. There's a lot of history that was created in the 19th century, a lot of it, between 1800 and 1900. There was an awful lot of history, a tremendous amount of history that was created that we don't have as good a records as we should have. You know, it's probably there, but there's been a concerted effort on the part of some scoundrels to steal and destroy some very key documents. We found that out when we did the research on the 16th Amendment. We found out that, you know, the Library of Congress was, they lied to us when we asked them for a copy of Senate Document 240. They said it didn't exist anymore. Well, we eventually found them, and since then, I know of one gentleman that went to Washington, D.C., and he found two copies of it right in the Library of Congress. And so we know there's been political influence out there that has been used to shortchange us and steal key documents And, of course, you have to remember now that the European monarchies, they were all intermarried, you know, and such, and they, you know, they did not like the system of government that had been created in this country by the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Those, the European monarchies, they determined that it would jeopardize their futures, their divine right of kings. It would jeopardize that if the people of this country would be sovereign and that they would have control of their government. The monarchies, they wanted control over there in Europe. They wanted absolute control of those countries over there where they were located. And, of course, Magna Carta coming in 1215 A.D., they, you know, they tried to destroy that. The monarchies of Europe, they were embedded in all those countries over there, and they would stick together with each other in many ways and many different things. And so they were an influence in this country. And, of course, they were very much involved, actually, behind the scenes in our Civil War.
Well, you know, at go.com, I keep bringing this up, which is an acronym for Get Out of Our House. One of the questions that they have in their candidate questionnaire is whether or not you would vote for an amendment prohibiting lawyers from running for the House of Representatives. And you have to answer that question if you put yourself up to be a candidate, and if you get elected and you vote the opposite of however you answer that question, as it's true with all the questions, then you agree to resign your position if you go against it.
Mm-hmm.
And that got me really looking into that and thinking about it. And you start looking today. You know, we talk about getting rid of the incumbents, but you better take a doggone hard look at who's running in their place. And I believe if you'll look real close, you're going to find out that there's a high percentage, a disproportionate percentage of attorneys.
Oh, yes, definitely. Now, back about 15 years or so, 15 or 20 years ago, there were people in the state of Washington out here that they got an initiative. They have an initiative process here in this state, and they got an initiative on the ballot to limit attorneys and keep them out of the state legislature in particular, but they didn't have a lot of money to campaign or anything, and of course the lawyers, the legal profession, and the judges and all came out against it, and it lost. And you know, if the American people had understood the principles of the separation of power and such, they would have passed that, but they didn't understand it. And you see, because the opposition had plenty of money to go against that, you know, to brain damage the people, the voters out there, to vote against it. And you know, today I think it would be, if that initiative were to run today, I think it'd be a little easier to educate the people, the voters, about this and how important it is that we, you know, we understand that separation of powers and make it work the way the founders envisioned it. You know, it was a great, great idea, separation of powers. And, of course, you see, in the schools, in the public education, they taught us about the checks and balances between the three branches of government, the legislative, executive, and judicial. They didn't teach us, however, that the grand jury is a separate power. They didn't tell us that, you know, that the petit jury is a separate power. and that the grand jury is to be a check against the executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government. And, you know, they're just not, you know, the grand jury is not a check anymore because the people believe too many lies.
Well, now that brings us to back to where we started out at. I was just looking at your segment six in your book, talking about the right that secures rights, and also where do politicians come from in segment seven. You make a comment in here about politicians' egos and lust for power are so enlarged they leave no room for respect or compassion.
I didn't remember that, but I've been known to say things like that, I guess.
Well, I mean, that pretty much defines a liar to me, because they consider themselves so puffed up that they have no regard for how they deceive others.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I've really gotten to have that kind of taste in my mouth when I think about lawyers, because of the way that they really are officers of the court, and they really do not represent their clients. They represent themselves and the court. So I guess, you know, Red, in this last 14 minutes of this show, what would you like to share with the people on what are some of the best ways that we can break this addiction to being lied to and just living in the box that they've created for us? How are we going to break out of this box? How are we going to stop believing these lies? How are we going to make ourselves pay attention every day to hold these people accountable to the truth? How are we going to do that?
We've got to question everything that we have stored in our minds. I think in that little book, I said that that knowledge consists of truth stored in our minds. I don't remember where it would be in that book. You have to remember, that book is now 21 years old. I wrote it in 89. You know, we've got to question everything that we were taught about government in the government school situation. This is just another story. I'm probably rambling here a little bit, but back about 3 months or so or 4 months ago, you had a guest on, a minister from Pennsylvania, who...
Pastor Jim Grove.
Yes, and he spoke out against the corporate church and the 501c3. Well, one of your listeners... he is an active participant in a church in Southern California, and he may be listening tonight. Anyway, he took that pretty serious, what the pastor was saying, and I was saying the churches being controlled by the government, because they've become government churches with their corporate charters and their 501c3s and that type of thing. Well, he called you or the program, and they give him my phone number, and I've had considerable conversations with him, and it's been going on here, and he's been trying to get the pastors they've got a senior pastor and three assistant pastors. And he's been trying to get them, that church has a 501c3 contract with the Internal Revenue Service. And boy, it's been an interesting, a an interesting thing to watch because the senior pastor, you know, he's talking about our democracy and how that the people control our democracy. We haven't controlled this democracy for the last 40 or 50 years. This so-called democracy we have, the people of this country have lost control of this democracy. It's no more democracy than the man in the moon is our king. You know, it just, these lies are so embedded in people. I recommend that they watch those videos on Google, and they do, but they don't, they need to watch them more than once, because you don't overcome lies that are so embedded in people. You don't just root those lies out that you have lived with all your life. You just don't get rid of them without some effort, and it takes the effort and the time, and people need to really study it. They have to be a concerned American, of course, and if they're really concerned, they'll take the time, they'll take the, you know, use the effort that it takes to, get rid of this this belief system that that we have so, it is so much a part of us. We're talking about electing new congressmen and such. That, you know, I'm telling people, don't contribute to the political efforts, the campaigns of these congressmen for Congress and such. Don't put your bucks there. If you've got bucks to spend, give them to the Fully Informed Jury Association, because they're spending the money to help people overcome all these lies and such. And that's the most important check in the system that we can do anything about at this point. But we believe that Congress is the solution, getting the right people elected. That's not the solution. That's not the solution. It's part of the solution. The biggest thing that, the most important thing that we do is get our grand juries functioning again to where they put the heat on these congressmen and senators when they get out of line, when they start telling lies, and then they start trying to take our guns and such. We need to call them in to a grand jury and say, well, here's what you promised in the campaign, and now here's what you're doing after you're elected. That's, a grand jury can call these people in and say, you're dishonest. You don't have any integrity.
Well, I'm glad there's at least a few people in this life that still have some integrity, Red, and I appreciate you highly for the way that you've stuck your neck out over the years to tell the truth, even when it's been not been the easiest path to take. And I'm really respectful of the people who went to the Continental Congress for that reason, that they really are making an effort. You know, they're not perfect; they're average Joes, but you know, there's some really bright people in that group, but, you know, all in all, they're pretty much common people who are just trying to survive in this life and find a proper and righteous path to be on. And I really highly respect the fact that they were willing to stick their necks out and take a chance to maybe bring just a little bit of truth to the people, especially related to the Constitution. And I want to urge everybody that hasn't, that's listening, that if you haven't gone over and read the Articles of Freedom, I'll post the website on the chat room right now so that everyone can go over there and read them and sign the pledge of the Articles of Freedom. You'll get an education on the Constitution just by reading them. I mean, it'll There's a lot there. Most of it addresses violations of the Constitution. But that's next week. I'd like to announce we're going to have a special guest next Thursday, Gary Fielder. Gary is a criminal and Constitution attorney, but I can joke with him. I mean, he has the same feeling about attorneys that I have, I think. If he's listening, I hope he doesn't shoot me for making that comment. But he'll be on here, and he's put together a new lecture. He's the one that did the Gig Is Up, the lecture on the Federal Reserve, fractional reserve banking, the derivative bubble. Well, he's been focusing on the concept of sovereignty, and he's prepared a new lecture that he'll be giving on January the 30th, which I hope to attend. But he's going to be on our show next Thursday night, Red. So have your sovereignty hat on, and we're gonna spend the whole 2 hours of next Thursday night talking specifically about the concept of sovereignty. I'm looking forward to that greatly. Let's see what Janet's trying to buzz me for. We've got 4 minutes left. Red, if anybody have any questions of us, please call in and feel free to join on our conversation. We usually have more people calling in than we did tonight. We didn't have anybody calling in tonight. But I've been watching the chat room, and a lot of my friends from Rose's gang, from Rosetta's sister, .wordpress.com has been in the chat room tonight, and the conversation that's gone on in there has been just as good or better than what we've been talking about. Red Tallulah Star has been in there, and she's been telling them about some of the things going on with abortion and fetuses and the health care bill and some really interesting stuff. So it's been almost hard for me to concentrate on what we're talking about with what's been going on in that chat room tonight. But so it's been a real party going on over there with a lot of people who communicate on a regular basis. But so it's been a good night even in our chat room. I wish you could have seen some of that. We got 3 minutes left, Red. I'll let you close it out for us. We're talking about some of the things that you mentioned in your book are about psychoterrorists, the enemy within. Would you like to maybe address that issue?
Well, the Internal Revenue Service is a psychoterrorist organization. They, I would have more respect for somebody that would, go to Washington D.C. and go on some kind of a shooting rampage. A terrorist. They would be called a terrorist. The Internal Revenue Service, they're the worst kind of terrorists of all, because they attack the mind of people, and their weapon, of course, is fear. And one terrorist, suppose he takes out 20 or 30 people. How many people in this country are going to lose a lot of sleep tonight? They don't eat right, they don't sleep right, or anything else, because they've got this monster that is eating them alive with their psychological warfare. Hundreds of thousands of people out there are under the gun. They're being pressured by this rogue outfit, and they have absolutely no legal right to exist, because the 16th Amendment, the income tax amendment, is null and void. It is a fraud. We have the documentation to prove it, and we've got courts that are so corrupt that they have covered up this crime. And I'm here to tell you that we've got to bring these people back under the law, under the Constitution, and we've got to, bring the IRS down. We've got to put them out of business, and we can do it. All we have to do is get with the program and get ourselves straightened out in our minds about what's going on in this country and how to bring this country back. And I think I've run out of time.
And well, good time you've done doing it too. Great ending there, Red. Appreciate you a lot, my friend, and I look forward to talking to you maybe tomorrow. We need to talk to David about that initiative on the jury in Colorado. Thanks for joining us tonight. Great show. Thanks, Red. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Same time, same station.
Good night. We'll be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar. Go and tell that midnight rider. Tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.